Today on Doomed, we're debunking the Holocaust deniers with Dr. Andrew E. Mathis. He's an adjunct professor of humanities at the University of the Sciences in Philadelphia, who tracks the conspiracy theorists at his website, Holocaust Controversies. I'm your host, Matt Binder, and this is Doomed. All right. Let's bring down the song. Let's bring us up on the camera here. Bum, bum, bum. There we go. Andrew, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
Now, you've been actually, let's give people a little bit of background here. Full disclosure, you have been a longtime listener of mine, but not of this show, from my time on the Majority Report with Sam Seder.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. For probably, I guess, going on. So, well, how long have you been gone, for one thing?
It's been a while now that I've been gone. But, man.
When I started watching, you and Michael were there, but Kelly was not.
Okay. So that should give you some. Yeah. Yeah. So that was sometime between the years 2011 and 20. Well, if Michael was there, then sometimes between the years of 2012 and 2015.
Right.
So yeah, you're an old timer.
An old timer, right.
All right. And as you called me when you picked up the phone, old Matt, as I'm known to the Majority Report audience, which I responded to you. It's becoming literal now as I age and look like I do today. let's get serious now, because you know, we're about to get into some heavy stuff. The show is called Doomed, although I would say I do a pretty good job of not making everyone feel like we should all just go off and live in an underground bunker when I end the show. But anyway, the show is called Doomed, and you reached out to me, and I've been looking at your work, and it's Holocaust Remembrance Day, and you have been basically tracking these conspiracy theorists, these fringe figures who, I mean, the most straightforward thing to describe them as is they're Holocaust deniers.
Yeah.
And, I mean, this is something that you would used to hear someone say this and, you know, bring up some of these things you're about to tell us about. And most people would say automatically, is these people are nuts, out of their mind, something is wrong with them.
Yeah.
But in recent years, you know, we've seen some of these people who hold some of these very same views. Maybe they're known for other things than just being Holocaust deniers, but some of these people are now in the mainstream right. And not only that, you know, not only shit up Holocaust denialism, but, you know, we have folks, you know, just today, just to bring up a current event, speaking of this stuff, Facebook basically banned about half a dozen people who range from Alex Jones to Farrakhan to Laura Loomer.
Noted far leftist Louis Farrakhan.
Right, yes. Paul Nealon, Milo Yiannopoulos, Prison Paul Joseph Watson. I would say there's a few of these names who have dabbled in this sort of at least the same realm as Holocaust deniers. I mean, hell, bring up Candace Owens, who just left Turning Point USA just a few weeks ago, or maybe it was a month ago, max, where she's out there saying, if Hitler didn't move outside of Germany, have been such a bad guy.
You
know, this may not, you know, maybe she's not the same as some of the folks you're about to tell me, but it's certainly well within the realm, and maybe if I'm being kind, a step or two away from full-on being that.
I think that's definitely true. I mean, Watson actually sort of like he went over to the dark side relatively recently in terms of being right out there as a Holocaust denier. He was kind of on the precipice for a while and he took the great leap within the last year, actually sort of openly taking a position. Him and Ron Unz actually was the other one that was that had been kind of playing around with it for a while and came out and openly stated a position. Unz is a weird case too, because he's Jewish on top of it, and so there's a very small minority among this group of people that are Jewish. The vast majority are not. But Unz was sort of like the most recent figure on my radar to go over and openly state that he was as he styles himself, like a skeptic.
Right. So let's actually, you know, probably as much as I know about far right fringe movements, I would say most of my knowledge is within the modern right. I would say maybe the past 10, 15, maybe 20 years. But this specific area, Holocaust denial and the deniers who've built this movement, I mean, go back probably to when it was happening, when the Holocaust was actually, going on during World War II. Please give us a bit of history behind where these conspiracy theories come from. Sort of who were the earliest names denying what was going on in Nazi Germany at the time, and let's just start there actually before I throw 20 more questions at you, because I got a lot. Right.
Yeah. So as you point out, I mean the denial begins while the crimes are still going on, but once the war is over and the Nazis have lost and some of them are in custody, a lot of them are put on trial at Nuremberg, fewer put on trial elsewhere. The denial starts there, but it's really difficult for a lot of them to just sort of like flat out deny that that anything has happened, so much as to say that they weren't personally involved or they didn't know what was going on, those kinds of things. But almost immediately after the war, there is a strand of these people that make their way into the European far right almost immediately, really, because a lot of them end up. First of all, obviously, we all know about the ones that end up in Latin America. But also a fairly large number of them end up in Spain, because Franco is, although Franco has not cooperated with the Nazis really at all during the war, he's open to the idea of giving them shelter in Spain and not sending them back to be put on trial. So a lot of the high-ranking SS guys, particularly the ones that are Catholic, end up in Spain, and they begin sort of setting up far-right networks pretty much immediately after the war. And a lot of those guys are deniers. There's German politician Otto Ernst Remmer. He's one of the earliest, like first generation ones. Former a guy from Wallonia who was in the Waffen SS, Leon de Grell. He's and they're out there sort of making their case from Spain or from actually for Remmer. He's actually in Germany and gets in sort of big trouble, making the case that at the very least, it's been completely overblown, that that the number of Jews that have been killed is massively overestimated, and that moreover, for those Jews that were killed, that it was absolutely a matter of anti-partisan warfare. Germany had a legitimate grievance against the Jews, that kind of thing, and so they're sort of circulating on the far right, not getting a lot of mileage, until really sort of two things happen. The first one is in the United States. There's a guy, Francis Parker Yockey is his name, and he drifts over to the far right at some point during the war, but ends up working on the Nuremberg trials after the war. And he sort of goes there on his own personal initiative as like a mole to go over there and try to actually help out the people that he's supposed to be prosecuting. He sets up these sort of very extensive networks in the far right in Europe, comes back to the United States, and is arrested for traveling on a false passport. He gets thrown into jail, and the visitor that he gets while he's in jail is a guy named Willis Cardo. Willis Cardo is like the godfather of the far right post-World War II in the United States. He just died last year, but he's the guy that puts Holocaust denial on the map in the United States. And he's able to sort of leverage his relationship with Yockey into a much more extensive relationship on the far right throughout Europe and North and South America. That's one. Two is the emergence, first in the 60s in France, a guy named Paul Racinier, who actually had been a member of the French Resistance during the war. He had been arrested by the Gestapo, put in Middelbaldura, a prison camp in France, and then began in the 60s writing books, basically saying like, I've been in Nazi concentration camps and I didn't see any gas chambers, you know, that kind of thing. And he's like expelled from the Communist Party. He was actually in the parliament at one point in France. He was expelled from the parliament. He doesn't get a lot of reverberation for what he's doing until he finds this sort of very publicly vocal acolyte, a guy named Robert Fonson. And Fonson also died last year. And he's the person that actually brings Holocaust denial public. And he and Cardo have a long cooperative relationship where they're both publishing Holocaust denial material in Europe and in the United States, setting up conferences. Cardo sets up the Institute for Historical Review in the United States. Fonson is a very common guest for the IHR to speak at their conferences. And they begin to attract around them a kind of a clique of people who are generating this material. The vast majority of them are on the very far right. A couple of them are able to sort of put out an outward appearance of being apolitical. There's a professor of electrical engineering at Northwestern, a guy named Arthur Butz, and he publishes a book in the late 70s called The Hoax of the 20th Century. And this is one of the sort of the most important pieces of Holocaust denial literature that's ever published, because he has some air of respectability because he doesn't have any sort of outward Nazi trappings about him. And he's actually a legitimate professor at a very good university with tenure. So, of course, he can't get in any trouble.
Right.
But he's willing to sort of make this public case. And right around the time that Butz publishes, David Irving, who over in England has been for a couple of decades at that point, a major right-wing historian of Nazi Germany, but very much still in the mainstream. He publishes a book in 77 called Hitler's War. And in Hitler's War, he puts forward this thesis that Hitler didn't know about the Holocaust, that it was essentially being carried out by people against his wishes, on the independent initiative of people that were essentially trying to keep this undertaking from him. And Irving's project from that point forward is exonerating Hitler. It's that the Nazis might have done bad things, but really, if you line Hitler up against Churchill in particular, that Hitler really is the far more reputable character of these two. And over a course of about 15 to 20 years, Irving begins to sort of sink deeper and deeper into it, particularly as he alienates more and more of his mainstream publishing counterparts, until finally he loses a book contract in the early 90s. He has a contract with St. Martin's Press. They're going to publish his biography of Joseph Goebbels, the Nazi propaganda minister. They pull out basically because there's enormous pressure from like the ADL and groups like that. And he sort of publicly declares his disbelief in the Holocaust sort of outright at that point. And that's also a very important moment because it's right around that very same time that the World Wide Web is really exploding and people are getting online. And Irving has a very good reputation as a historian. So and plus he's cooperated with the IHR. He's come to their conferences. He's done the whole, rubber chicken circuit with those people. So he's been living in both worlds at this point. But now fans of military history that have been reading Irving for years are going to get drawn into it. The sort of the classic far right circle who's already into it now can sort of embrace Irving fully as a kind of vehicle toward greater legitimacy. Because, I mean, Irving's the kind of guy that has his books reviewed in the New York Review of Books. He's a big deal. So at least back then. So it's really between the time that he loses that book contract and the time that he sues Deborah Lipstadt for libel, which is in the late 90s, that there's like a crescendo of Holocaust denial activity. And it really peaks then when Irving loses that trial. It dips. But then after 9/11, it really peaks again, probably as a consequence of all the conspiracy theories that's tied into that.
Now, let's actually, what I find really interesting, actually, and you brought it up, is how this sort of move to, you know, how it sort of, it's almost like it has its own secondary movement in Latin America, like you mentioned. Can you go a little bit more into the history behind that?
Yeah, it's not something I can talk a lot about because I'm not very strong on it. But the figure actually that it sort of centers around the most is Adolf Eichmann, of course, because he's the at the end of the war, and particularly after the Nuremberg trials, when the major figures have been executed, Eichmann is the last man standing in terms of the of command responsibility for the Holocaust. Eichmann is the guy, and he's at large. And he makes sort of the really foundational error of not keeping a low enough profile. He does an interview with a far right Dutch. I'm not going to remember the guy's name, unfortunately. Sassen is the guy's name. Willem Sassen does an interview with him that gets it gets circulated in Life magazine, for instance. And so even before the Israelis lay their hands on him in '60, I guess, he's already sort of popped up on the radar. And to some extent, the far right movement, he's maintained ties with the far right movement all along in Europe, although he can't travel, obviously. There, there are far right figures that are going back and forth. There's a political figure in Argentina. There's important to sort of stipulate. I mean, there are a lot of German Argentinians, and so there's a fair amount of travel that goes back and forth between those countries. Political figures are mobilizing. Perón has a big base of support in the far right, even though he's not technically really far right himself. Like Franco, however, he gives a safe harbor for these people, mainly just kind of to stick it to the United States and to the UK, probably more than anything else. But Eichmann becomes a kind of rallying point because when Eichmann, and it's a little bit sort of counterintuitive, because when Eichmann comes forward, he doesn't deny that he did anything. I mean, he denies any personal responsibility, just saying, you know, his job was, you know, to sign a manifest of people being put on trains. And by and large, that's true. But at the same time, he's not claiming that there were no exterminations. He's just claiming that it was a necessary part of what he had been asked to do. After all, you know, Germany's war was against Bolshevism, and the Jews were carriers of the Bolshevik idea. And so, of course, a war against Bolshevism to the death was going to mean the death of, you know, of millions of Jews. And he stood by what he had done. And so, and I guess sort of the point about Eichmann and this thing that's happening in the late 50s, early 60s, is that a significant proportion of the people that deny the Holocaust, they're perfectly aware that it happened. And so they're looking to have, to legitimize a particular point of view that will be useful for rehabilitating the Nazis politically. So that's one part of what they're doing. But at the same time, they feel perfectly comfortable championing somebody who says, look, the Jews were all communists. We had to take care of them because that's, after all, the way that they really feel. So in some sense, they're kind of trying to, like, you know, have their cake and eat it, too. But there is a certain amount of dishonesty there that they, you know, they really sort of know what actually happened and are really denying it as a kind of political thing. The movement itself, Holocaust denial within South America, is really, I would say, like tertiary behind the one in the United States and the one in Europe.
Right, right. I would just found it, you know, because when I was, geez, going back to my high school years, I think, or before I was, you know, I was into politics at the time, but I, you know, I barely knew, like, you know, things like that. And yeah. I remember just watching a soccer game with a buddy, same age, and he's just like, pointing out all the German people on, like, the Argentina team, all the people with German names on the Argentina team, yeah, or something. And he's like, you know why that is, right? And then from that moment, I was like, that's crazy. Like,
yeah. I mean, there was a huge exodus that happened of people in the SS that took place. I mean, it was facilitated largely by the Vatican, and these people got funneled through the Vatican and found safe harbor. A very large number, obviously, in Latin America, but as I mentioned before, a large number in Spain and Portugal, too, because these were, authoritarian, right-wing, very Catholic states, and with good relationships with the Vatican. And the idea here was, you know, and it sort of is contiguous with the stuff we've been talking about already. The standpoint of the Vatican during the war, by and large, was that the Nazis were the lesser of two evils, because even though what they were doing was awful, the communists were worse because they were anti-religion. And if it meant having to take a side in a war between the Nazis and the Soviets, they were going to choose the Nazis because the Nazis, and this was actually even a mistaken idea because the Nazis would have moved against the church at some point. But they were at least operating on the mistaken ideal that the Nazis wouldn't, but the Soviets certainly would. And so a fight against the Soviet Union was a fight to keep religion viable in Europe. And so they chose their sides. And when the war ended, they wanted to be sure that those people who they saw as fighting this holy crusade against communism were going to pay with their lives. And that's why they did what they did and why all those war criminals ended up in South America.
Right, right. So let's now... So how did this, let's start moving towards, I guess, where we are today. So how did it go from that, you know, how did those figures basically bring this into what really is, like, how did it move into what we see currently in current day? I mean, we're literally just days removed from one synagogue shooting among, I don't even know how many there have been. There's been the one in Pittsburgh, and then the most recent one. And you know, there's no doubt about it that, you know, these white supremacists might, you know, some of them might not deny the Holocaust, but they're all in the same realm, like I was saying earlier.
Yeah.
So how did we get here, basically?
The internet's a big part of it. It's a very big part of it. And because, you know, before there was, internet access in every home, it was very much a fringe movement. I think that you could literally count on the knuckles of a single finger the number of Holocaust deniers that held advanced history degrees. And so they had no legitimacy whatsoever in academia, and they were completely ignored there. I mentioned Butz before, but he's an electrical engineer. And so, as long as he was tenured, so he could be dead wood in engineering and just publish Holocaust denial stuff. And he would be largely ignored. And as long as he didn't bring any of it into his classroom, he stayed good with with Northwestern. But the rest of these people, they'd come to these meetings and they'd circulate their literature pretty much among themselves. The far right, the neo-Nazi parties that would pop up every now and then and the KKK, they would be, useful conduits for getting that stuff out. But it really didn't reverberate very much at all. Not to the extent, for instance, that Faurisson did in the 70s in France. And to some extent, France was just a better kind of ground for that kind of thing. I don't know what you know about like French politics, but basically French politics has been divided on the issue of anti-Semitism since the 1880s. Right. And it pretty much remains that way. I mean, it's really, the pro-Dreyfusards on the left, the anti-Dreyfusards on the right, and their positions on this treason trial that happens in the 1880s. So, I mean, Faurisson's playing into all that stuff. I mean, all that stuff gets, it gets whipped up into an absolute frenzy during the war. It dies down a little bit afterward. And it's difficult for people on the far right in France to make sort of a vocal presentation of their points of view because of, the heroism of the resistance, which is very closely tied to the left in France. But with Faurisson, who, by the way, I don't think I mentioned this before, he's a professor of literature at the University of Paris. So he's a legitimate academic figure, although, again, not an historian. He is now sort of presenting this material in a way that giving it sort of a veneer of respectability, and actually sort of what does a little bit more damage. And it's a sort of one of these episodes in this whole area that gets played up in the wrong way, I think. But it's actually Noam Chomsky plays an unwittingly bad role in this when he's asked by a mutual friend of his in Faurisson to write an introduction to one of Faurisson's books. And he does without sort of realizing the gravity of what it is that he's done. After which, of course, he renounces it and, says that the guy's free to say what he wants, but he's an idiot for saying it and so on and so forth. But that brings much greater attention in the United States to the issue than it would have otherwise. Anti-Semitism in France is, it's pretty much constant. Faurisson, caused like an uptick of it, and then it dies down again. It doesn't really get consistently sort of buoyed to the extent that that can explain what we see now until the internet, because it's like anything else. it provides community for people that wouldn't otherwise have it. So, you know, if you're some neo-Nazi, you know, someplace in the middle of the United States and you think the Holocaust is a great big hoax, you know, good for you. I mean, but you, who are you going to share that idea with?
Would you say that, you know, between the time of, I guess, you know, like you were giving the history earlier, you know, around the time of the Holocaust and right after, and then between the age of the internet, I guess, late 90s, early 2000s, when it sort of, when everyone starts to have it, at least in the U.S., would you say the time in between, like the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, it's sort of a dying sort of movement? Or, how would you characterize the time in between? Or is it sort of just like clinging on to...
It clings to life. It clings to life, but just barely. I mean, it's just a tiny little percentage of people that are out there doing it.
Right.
I mean, they can't really get traction among like the neo-Nazi set, because among the neo-Nazi set, you've got a big proportion of people who are like 6 million more. Like they want to hang their hat on the fact that the Nazis killed millions of Jews. They're proud of it, and they want it to be something that they can sort of follow up on by seizing power again. They see Holocaust denial as idiotic because, you know, let's face it, the Nazis lost the war. So if there's no Holocaust, then they really didn't accomplish anything from their standpoint. So the Holocaust deniers can't even really get traction among these people. Now that said, I mean, I can remember when I first encountered Holocaust denial. I was in my early 20s, so like almost 30 years ago. And it was a talk show host on local talk radio here in Philadelphia, a guy named Irv Homer, who since has passed away. He had on two guys. He had on August Kreis, who later went on to be the head of Aryan Nations, and who actually now is in prison for raping his daughter. And he had Mark Thomas, who was a Christian identity preacher from, I think, from Allentown. He went to prison he joined what the Aryan Republican Army, and he went to prison for some relationship with one of the people involved in Oklahoma City bombing. And these two guys were both talking Holocaust denial, but they were in the small minority of people at that point in the far right who were espousing it, because for the most part, Holocaust denial was something that was trying to give far-right politics of veneer respectability. If you were wearing a swastika armband, I mean, you weren't gonna fool anybody. So, yeah, I mean, really until the internet, it was just this tiny little community of people who were trying to get traction. They would do things like they would submit their papers to peer-reviewed journals, and they would get laughed off. Bradley Smith out in California would try to take out ads in college newspapers, and every once in a while, somebody would buy one, and then that would cause a little uptick in the attention that they would get, and then it would go away again. But really, it's Irving and it's the internet. Those are the big factors that really put it on the map in the 90s.
Right. You know, I bring that up because, I mean, obviously a lot of these conspiracy theories and fringe movements blew up in the age of the internet, but, you know, they got bigger and the movements got stronger, but they still had some sort of life during the time in between. You know, the time before the internet, you know, it's interesting to me because the idea of, you know, white supremacy, these things existed in the 70s. Like, this was not something that was barely a blip on the radar before the internet. But I do feel like Holocaust, like just flat out denying the Holocaust is something that I, you know, before the internet, I really did not even... It's something you didn't come across.
Yeah, I mean, it really is true. The internet is like the greatest thing that ever happened for these people, because the other part of it, not only is it the finding of community, but they finally have a megaphone like they've never had before. So if you get some guy that knows even a little bit about search engine optimization, puts up a website, you know, loads it up with the right keywords and the right code, and now all of a sudden he can put his stuff in the middle of everything else. It's going to come up on a search engine search when somebody puts in, you know, just types in Holocaust. And I haven't looked in a really long time, but I would imagine that even today, if you typed in Holocaust into Google, you're going to get on the first page of hits. You're going to get Committee for Open Debate on the Holocaust. You're going to get David Irving in there someplace. you know, and that's an absolute win for them. That's much more publicity than they could have ever had before.
Now, you brought up before how, you know, how it doesn't help the Nazis to deny it was a win for them that the Holocaust happened, obviously.
Right, right.
But it's sort of bizarre to me. I'm stuttering here because I can't even put it to words. The idea that they would sort of, they're in the same like category though, basically. Like, these people clearly both are anti-Semitic, but on but on one end you have people who are saying nothing happened to them, and on the other end you're saying that we did something very bad to them. it's just bizarre to me that these worlds collide, I guess.
The way that we always used to sort of sum it up was to say that they could have a slogan. Their slogan would be, there was no Holocaust, but the Jews certainly deserved it. Like, you know, that was like sort of the way their whole position could be summarized in that way. You make a good point here as well, which is that, you know, we really can't forget that what lies at the core of this is just a deep-seated hatred of Jews. And to think that something like the Holocaust could be faked implies a conspiracy of just, you know, tremendous proportion, you know, of the likes of which, you know, would dwarf moon landing conspiracies or, you know, 9/11 conspiracies. Just the sheer number of people involved to be involved in something like that, right, and to coordinate their stories, you know, and all this over five continents in 75 years.
Listen, a lot of crisis actors would have gotten their SAG card back in
Absolutely. It
would have been a boon for it doesn't make, you're absolutely, it's ridiculous. And speaking of crisis actors, I mean, this has to be, I guess, I'm sure there's some sort of, we could go further back. I bet there's people going 1400s, I'm sure, if we're going all the way back. There's probably some sort of people who believe some sort of crisis actor movement from the day Columbus claims he discovered America, even though there are people already here. But the Holocaust deniers have to be, I guess, the godfathers of the crisis actor belief.
Yeah, I mean, essentially, because it begins to address a certain aspect of their sort of like their techniques, like the way that they operate, right? So because the Nazis were trying to hide what they did, and because they had the opportunity to destroy a lot of evidence for what they had done, the evidence base for the Holocaust is not that great. And a significant proportion of the evidence that we do have are survivors, obviously, not to mention perpetrators, which is, you know, an incredibly important body of witnesses. But the deniers really focus more than anything else on the witnesses, on the survivors. And so they will, a basic sort of fundamental rule of history is that you rely more on what you can corroborate and less on what you can't, right?
Right.
And so you've got, you know, if you have literally hundreds of people who were in a camp that had gas chambers in it, and these people are all saying, yeah, there were gas chambers at this camp, that's a significant amount of corroboration for this particular version of events. Now, what the deniers will do is, instead of looking at the corroboration and where all these testimonies agree with each other in the main, they'll say, well, okay, well, this witness said that there were 8 gas chambers and this witness said that there were 6. So clearly that means that somebody made a mistake in the story that they were told to tell. And that provides proof that there's some lie being told. Or, you know, this one says the gas chamber could hold 1,000 people. This one says it could hold 1,500. So that tells us that something's wrong. Now, anybody that knows anything about eyewitness testimony also knows that it's extraordinarily unreliable, particularly in terms of the details that are provided. And so it's important that you have a big body of it to be able to corroborate it. But, you know, in this particular case, we do. The only reason, by the way, that we have it is because in 3 of the 6 death camps, there were revolts. And so there were enough survivors to come out of these camps to say what it was that actually happened there. Whereas for the two of the six camps had no revolt whatsoever. One of those camps had two survivors, and the other one had less than a dozen. So, I mean, you know, what we know about those camps, we know by and large from perpetrators and from some documents that managed to survive. But I mean, if you are a Holocaust survivor, the fact that the most significant base of evidence is eyewitnesses is like a gold mine for them, because you can pick apart an eyewitness on virtually anything. I mean, defense lawyers do that for a living.
Right. Right. If only some of the, you know, the Jews at these camps had, you know, took out their cell phones and took some video, I guess, you know, I mean, I guess that's what they want, right? That's what the, go ahead.
At Auschwitz, what the Nazis would do was they would employ a small group of Jews to remove dead bodies from gas chambers and move them to crematory ovens. It's gruesome shit, right? I mean, obviously. And then, like, you know, every few weeks they would just shoot these guys and they would get a new bunch of them. And that's how they operate. And a lot of these guys were perfectly aware of the fact that no Jews might survive at all. And they felt that it was really incredibly necessary for them to document in any way possible what was going on at that time. A lot of them wrote stuff down and then buried it underground. And even today, some of that stuff is still being found, still being, you know, subjected to scientific analysis, you know, like, some of the paper that it was written on is really badly decayed, so it's been necessary to, like, you know, run it through an MRI and stuff like that. But, like, at one of the crematoria in Auschwitz-Birkenau, there are four photographs that these guys managed to take and bury. I mean, it's like, and we know, I mean, one of the pictures is an enormous burning pit with these men pushing bodies into it to be burned. And, you know, and the only thing that Holocaust deniers can say in the face of actual photographic evidence of what it was that was going on is to sort of claim that the photographs are faked based on their poor quality. Well, of course, they're poor quality photographs. They're being taken in 1943 with a hidden camera, and then they're being buried underground for 20 years. What do you want?
Oh, my God.
Yeah. I mean, it's just and so, you know, the arguments are tend to be like that, basically. And the other thing is that, you know, if there's anything that can appear even remotely exculpatory, they'll focus entirely on that, and then to the absolute exclusion of everything that is completely damning in the testimony or in the documents or anything else.
Now
which is, you know,
no, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
No, please go ahead.
I was just going to say, it's, you know, one of the reasons why so few of these people have advanced history degrees is because, you know, getting an advanced history degree, they would know not to write history that way. You know, that you don't do that with historical evidence. It's, you know, you don't find a smoking gun, as they would call it, and say, okay, well, that means that everything over here that made the case that I disagree with, now I have to completely dismiss. The sort of the basic principles of historical evidence state that, you know, you incorporate that. You don't take this and ignore that. You take this and you incorporate it with everything else. You find a narrative that makes it all fit. And if you can't, then you have more work to do, basically. But what you don't do is to say, okay, well, I found something new, and that means everything's wrong.
Right, right. When you were bringing up all these professors who had sort of engineering, whether engineering professor, literary professor, it is sort of interesting that you mentioned it over and over, but I just kept going in my head over as well. You know, I guess it's sort of, especially like I think you even said with the literary professor, he sort of helped create a more, I don't know, a more professional sort of dissertation of it all. I do wonder if that's sort of someone with that background was able to sort of, would a historian, would a professor of history, even if they were a Holocaust denier, which they wouldn't be doing a very good job, very good at their job, you know, would they be able to craft it in a way that would have taken off like this literary guy did?
Well, I mean, you know, to his credit, I think David Irving managed to do that to some extent for a little while. But when he just began to push ideas that were too controversial, the pushback actually that he got was from within the historical community. So he's trying to a certain extent, capitalize on trends in German historiography in the 60s and 70s, right? So there's his book, Hitler's War in 77, he's talking about like trying to exculpate Hitler from the process, right? To remove Hitler from the process, and that way he can preserve Hitler but still acknowledge the Nazis were bad and did terrible things, right?
Right.
In doing that, he is trying to exploit a bunch of researchers, mainly from Germany, but there are a couple in the United States during the 60s and 70s, who are espousing a sort of school of historiography called functionalism, which basically says there wasn't like a master plan before the war started to do this. It sort of unfolded in bits and pieces over the course of events with the war. If the war had gone differently, then perhaps things would have gone differently. And furthermore, that in fact, a lot of decision making was probably out of Hitler's hands. Now, they support that particular point of view, you know, based on historical evidence. What Irving tried to do was to sort of like capitalize on that trend to remove Hitler from the equation entirely. And when he did that, the pushback from these historians in Germany was just enormous. They just said, "What the hell are you doing? Like, you know, we acknowledge as, you know, as believers in this functionalist idea, that that there was a lot of important action that was undertaken by people much further down the chain of command. But, I mean, without Hitler at the top, none of this happens. You know, I mean, to try to remove him from it is just ludicrous." Right. And in that way, he actually just sort of began to alienate some of the people that had been defending him for a very long time. Because, you know, as strange as it may sound, particularly, you know, more than 40 years after the fact, Irving had done really important archival research and had brought forward documents that he had published for the first time. Like I said before, he was a big deal. He had his books, you know, regularly reviewed in the best journals and stuff like that. And, you know, I mean, just a sort of like a more popular culture reference. I mean, when Kurt Vonnegut wrote Slaughterhouse-Five in his introduction, he relies heavily on Irving's work about Dresden. It turns out that most of that work is wrong. I mean, but that book is also, you know, more than 50 years old. I mean, it was what we knew at the time on the basis of research that Irving had gone to Germany to do. He was a real historian at one point, but he began to just sort of push these fringe theories to such an extent that the only people that would accept him after a certain point was this fringe in the United States and to a lesser extent in Europe, who was very closely tied to the far right.
Right. Now, I'm looking at your site, Holocaust Controversies, and a name that I would say probably makes up 75% of your most recent pieces on there. The name that
keeps, Carlos Matonia.
Yep, the name that keeps popping up is this Carlos Matonia.
Carlos Matonia.
Who is this guy? Go ahead.
So Carlo Matonia has been knocking around for a long time. He is he's Italian. I believe he's from Northern Italy, I think, like Turin or Milan. I can't remember exactly where. He is by far the most productive, prolific of these guys. And in a lot of ways, he is the last man standing. Matonia, his output, first of all, is just enormous. And for years, he has worked with a guy named Jürgen Graf. Jürgen Graf is a Swiss Holocaust denier. He lives in Russia now. And he's a neo-Nazi. Like, Matonio has actually done a really good job over the course of his career as a Holocaust denier of keeping his hands out of politics. And so he has managed to, to some extent, sort of be above the fray. So, and for that reason, he sort of got attention that most Holocaust deniers don't get as a result of both. And he actually does archival research too, importantly, although he doesn't bring forth any documents that are new. As far as I know, he actually does go to archives and stuff like that. He does like the equivalent of real research. He's also fairly well educated. He has advanced degrees. Again, I think they're, think he might have a law degree. He definitely has a philosophy degree, but again, not a history degree. And so because of his relatively clean hands with regard to the politics aspect of it, because of his the volume of the stuff that he puts out, and because it has the appearance of being very scholarly at first glance, he has done very well in this particular field. And so he, I blog with six or seven other people at Holocaust Controversies, and they actually have paid significantly more attention to him than I have. I've written a handful of pieces on him, mainly just based on a new book that he wrote. But they actually took a significant portion of his work and just submitted it to painstaking historical inquiry. And if this was about 5 years, I guess it's actually more like 6 or 7 years now, they published a 500-page white paper that basically refuting Metonio's entire case. And there's been some back and forth since then. And Metonio's lost one of his co-authors. And, you know, he's also, you know, he's getting on in years, but he's sort of still going. And so from my standpoint, you know, I've done a lot of research on the Holocaust in Latvia. So I took the 20 pages or so that he dedicated in his last book to covering that topic and just, you know, took what I already knew and saw how well or poorly he had portrayed this information in these 20 pages. Because I was actually sort of on a hiatus from the blog at the time that they were doing this work, and so I wasn't involved in it at all. I hadn't actually read anything by Metonio. So I read Metonio for the first time, read 20 pages, and saw how many mistakes I could find. And there were just a boatload. I mean, just an enormous number of things that he did tremendously wrong. And it was both from the standpoint of just his methodology being for shit, which was, you know, I kind of expected. But also just there's a lag for their familiarity with historical research. Like, I'm probably doesn't come to any surprise to you or to anybody that's watching this that there's an enormous amount of historical research that gets done on the Holocaust. And your average Holocaust denier, when he, almost always he, is writing something trying to refute some aspect of the Holocaust, you know, that person's usually 20 years behind on the literature. So they're busy refuting some position that some historian took back in the 1980s or 90s that, you know, has already been either confirmed, you know, a dozen times or is no longer really believed because some other particular set of evidence or arguments has come along that they're just not familiar with. And Metonio just struck me as being in every way a complete sham. I mean, for all of his productivity, there was just nothing in there that that could get by, like a freshman history professor. You know, just that the arguments were bad, the treatment of the evidence was amateurish. I mean, if not just plainly dishonest. And you know, what it showed me was just that, you know, he's not any better than any of the rest of them. Some of them can give a kind of veneer of being scholarly, but in the end, they don't really know what they're doing. And that's, you know, obviously that's a benefit. I mean, the person that actually sort of organized the blog in the first place is a guy named Nick Terry, and he's a lecturer he's actually a senior lecturer now in history at the University of Exeter in the UK. He put together the blog when he was a grad student. And so he's been working on this stuff for a very, very long time. And so he sort of led the effort to refute Metonio's work using, you know, sort of the best principles possible, as well as the most cutting edge research and all of that stuff. And so, you know, somebody like Nick, who is a full-time historian and really knows what he's doing, could really take a guy like Metonio to task and really sort of, you know, show him for what he is. Almost no historians, unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, actually, really pay much attention to this, even though, as we've both already noted, for the last 20 years, it's just been much more out there than ever before. There's some attention paid to it, you know, in political science and sociology and ethics and law. But from the standpoint of history, it's largely ignored because the idea basically there is that if you were to actually pay it any attention, you'd be giving it more attention than it's worth.
Right. And another, another interesting point you brought up, obviously, is that the ladies have to step it up in the Holocaust denialism world. What's going on? I mean, you can't let the guys take all the credit. No, but
well,
but it is.
You do the far right conspiracy circuit, right?
Right.
I mean, so what's the gender breakdown as you?
It's easy. It's like literally 99% male, And the 1% of women actually end up being like sort of like the traditionalists.
Yeah.
Who, but when it comes to then, but then it usually gets to a point where the guy also obviously believes that same stuff. But obviously, if you're a trad wife, you're out there with a Twitter account talking about this stuff, because if we know about you, you're out there speaking.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, what happens with like 90% of that 1% of women, they end up posting about how like they're being abused because their husband doesn't want them online or some shit. Like they don't, they don't connect the sexism, the anti-feminist beliefs that that both her and her husband share to eventually fucking with their own shit. You know, it's it's a interesting dynamic to say the least.
But, yeah, it's not a very empowering environment for women, the far right. Yeah.
Right. I mean, how could you – literally, how could you be a major figure on the far right and be a woman when the misogyny is so necessary to those beliefs for the most part? I mean, obviously
Marine Le Pen is really the only one that I can think of off the top of my head.
Right. I'm also like, if you wanted to think like, you know, mainstream figures who were in politics, for sure. You're probably right. I can't think of any other off the top of my head. But, you know, for every Lauren Southern, I could name like 50 dudes. Like it's not even close.
Your Molyneux to Southern ratio is very, very large.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And it's, you know, another stunning thing to me, though, is sort of, actually, let me ask you this, first of all, because we actually talked a lot about the history, which is great, because that's how we need to start with this stuff. But let's focus a little bit more on, I guess, the current movement. Now, who is, like, I would say, because what I'm noticing is a lot of these guys skew older, which, again, we're talking, it's not weird to see, because it makes sense in a way for this specific movement. But who is the one of the younger big name, like what is the youngest of these big names in this world?
The biggest name for a while was this guy named Eric Hunt, and Eric Hunt he actually got himself famous about it's probably 15 years ago now. He accosted Elie Wiesel in an elevator in San Francisco, and he got sentenced to prison for 2 years. And he had been because he was convinced that the tattoo on Wiesel's arm was fake and wanted to confront him in person and get him to admit that he was lying about having been in Auschwitz.
Right.
And so he's a pretty disturbed kid. Like, you know, I call him a kid. He's probably well into his 30s at this point. The funny thing about Eric Hunt is that, you know, so he gets out of prison and he goes right back on the hobby horse with the Holocaust denial and all that. And he decides that he's going to be the guy that really carries the ball across the goal line. Like, he's going to be the guy that finally makes Holocaust denial a mainstream belief. And he sort of dedicates himself to doing some real research. And it occurs to him over the course of doing this research that he's wrong, that he can no longer really deny that the Holocaust actually happened, that the weight of the evidence that he's found is actually too great. So he renounces Holocaust denial. Now, he remains on the far right. He still hates Jews, but he just can't – he can no longer accept the idea that the Holocaust didn't happen, because he claims that it would be dishonest to do that. So he was like the young shining star of the Holocaust denial movement, and he's finished. I mean, he's left. He's just plain gone.
The weird thing about that to me, and please remember where you were leaving off, but the weird thing about that to me is, you know, when it comes to your general white supremacy, white nationalism, neo-Nazis, the KKK, I understand how young people fall into it, because these are, you know, they end up socializing with these types of people. It becomes their entire worldview, because they're hanging out with these people in real life. They're basically going to these websites, these forums, these chats, and it just envelops them. And, you know, these white supremacist beliefs hinge on what is perceived to them to be things that affect them in the real world, whether, you know, they don't have a girlfriend, they live in their parents' basement, maybe they do have a home, or maybe they do have a girlfriend. Doesn't necessarily mean these are all unsuccessful people, but there's something, let's put it this way, probably one of those beliefs for those types of people is they would have a better job and make more money if it wasn't for someone in the other groups stopping right. them from doing so, right. taking that job that's rightfully theirs. But it all hinges right. on things that affect their everyday life. And that's sort of, I get how people who are young could fall into that world. And there are, you know, it's important to get those people out because there are people who are stuck in this who aren't true believers. Yeah. But how do you fall into Holocaust denialism or whatever? How do you become a Holocaust denier in that way? Because you're not living that stuff. You literally just never logged on and Google searched Holocaust. Like, it's impossible. like it's not like, yeah. it's, like, it just doesn't make any sense. Like, I don't know whether to laugh or cry about that. Like, it's literally something where you can check out and see, oh, this is what happened. Like, you can't go on, like, you can't go online and be like, and search, and these guys can't find definitive proof that an immigrant didn't take their job. I mean, their studies, I'm sure, but they can't find the proof that that specific job wasn't taken by whatever guy has that specific job. I get that. It's still ridiculous, but in their mind, it makes sense. This, to me, you can. Like, it's not like it's not like they're living in it. Like, it's you look it up and you find out via photographic evidence, via first person. I mean, you can talk to people who who live through the Holocaust. Like, it's stunning to me that's the story of this guy.
So part of it is the conspiracy theory mindset. And again, it's not just the internet, but like 9/11 was a real boon for Holocaust denial, because once we began to get the narrative, in particular this narrative that 4,000 Jews were told not to go to work on 9/11, that very easily bleeds over into it was actually the Mossad that brought down the Twin Towers, right? And once you swallowed that, right? Because obviously it's easy to find an uninformed person. Tell them a few things that seem plausible, like, oh, those towers fell into their own footprint at near free fall speed, you know, that they're going to begin to believe in things like controlled demolition, and give them bits of information, you know, dancing Israelis and blah, blah, blah. Right. Now they believe that that Israel did 9/11. Now you've got the thin edge of the wedge in, and you can begin to tell them that that the Jews have done, you know, X, Y, and Z as well. Right. And so the beautiful thing about conspiracy theories is that they're a closed system, right? I mean, any new bit of information that you get just fits into the conspiracy. So you can be shown disproof or something that you believe as part of a conspiracy theory, but your way of assimilating that information is not going to be to change your mind. Your way of assimilating that information is going to be, well, of course they say that. They're part of the conspiracy.
Right.
Right. So
right.
Trust Wikipedia. Wikipedia is being manipulated by rooms full of Israeli soldiers whose sole job that it is to edit Wikipedia pages. You know, I can't trust any book published by a university press because, you know, all of the people that work at the university are left-wing Jews. So, of course, you know, that once you have somebody's mind sort of primed to apply that kind of confirmation bias to everything, then there's virtually nothing that they won't believe. That's why there's such a huge crossover between now these people that are espousing flat Earth
right.
and no moon landing.
But see, right? I totally get that in the sense that, you know, they're in the bubble. And once they're in, it's impossible almost to get out. But in that specific instance with that one guy, to me, it just seemed like so easy for him to just not believe it anymore. like as crazy as it's going to sound, if you are a Holocaust denier and you've been so and you're never going to change your mind, I understand the world you're in, because it makes, like you just said, it makes sense to them because that's all they know. But for someone to just be able to take that peek out and just drop it that quickly is just astounding.
Oh, he didn't drop it quickly, though. I mean, he'd been out there for 15 years. I mean, you got to, you know, on top of it, I mean, to not, this is not a joke. I mean, the kid's got a fairly serious mental illness. I mean, so,
I think they all at some level, right? I mean
this kid really did have a diagnosed mental illness. And I think, you know, to the extent that maybe it got under management, he might have, you know, got a bit of clarity, and that might have helped. I don't know that for sure. I'm just guessing, but I do know that he was diagnosed as mentally ill. I mean, so. You know, there's of course, you know, there's a fair number of them that have some series of issues. If, you know, if nothing else, then, you know, like personality disorder. But, you know, I think this kid actually had some genuine delusions that were maybe really tainting his way of thinking.
Right. Now, sorry, froze for a moment. Andrew. Thank you so much for joining us today. And I just want to, I definitely want to have you on again to go further into this, because we didn't even, to me, I don't even think we got even close to getting into sort of how this has sort of seeped into the current right.
I didn't even get to Chuck Johnson and Vox Day and Stix Hexenhammer and all these guys.
Right. And I think now that we've really dived into this history, I think that's why we should leave it there with that, because I think that's literally a whole nother hour, especially when you start talking about the guys I'm familiar with as well. So before we go, though, I just want to ask you, what is sort of, I guess, the, how do I put this? What would you say is the sort of where, not even to bring up those guys that we just mentioned, who we'll talk about next time, but where do you think Holocaust deniers are going, in the sense of, I don't know how to explain this, the more traditional deniers, in terms of people who believe it didn't happen, and they write this sort of fantasized history explaining how it didn't happen, sort of, I guess... Not to push their own white supremacist like Chuck Johnson and those guys do, but just for the classic anti-Semites, where do you think those guys are going?
Well, you know, unfortunately, I think we're seeing, you know, there's a resurgence. I mean, I think that, you know, that Trump has emboldened a significant proportion of these people that probably would have, you know, kept their heads below water if they didn't feel like they were going to be able to do some of the things that they've been doing lately. I mean, you know, we started this discussion, you mentioned the synagogue shootings over the last 6 months. I mean, that was like a regular thing in France, you know, in the years leading up to this past year here. And that's an unfortunate fact of life, you know, to be a minority in countries that are in which the pendulum is swinging right. And unfortunately, you know, it's as old as Europe is, basically, of Europe. And so it'll wax and wane. I think right now it's at a point where it's waxing. I am not fully discouraged against it waning at some point in the future. One thing that I sort of have been kind of clinging to over the course of the last couple of years is that, like, as far as white supremacy in the United States is concerned, this is really their last hurrah. I mean, the horse has really left the barn in terms of this being a white country. Right. I mean, demographics are demographics. And yeah, like, they're having their heyday right now. But the sheer fact of the matter is that it's not going to be a white country anymore, and they're going to lose. And so they can kick and scream as much as they want. But in the end, they're going to lose. And I think, you know, it's common sense to recognize that. With anti-Semitism, it's more complicated, unfortunately. It's not simply a matter of demographics, because Jews are always going to be a tiny minority. And that being the case, it's unfortunately, I think it's really a matter of of some amount of eternal vigilance. And that's, you know, I said this the other day in the aftermath to somebody the other day in the aftermath of the shooting in California. I said, you know, this was supposed to be the place where this didn't happen. This was supposed to be the country that we could live in where this kind of thing didn't happen on a regular basis. So it's, you know, it's disheartening, but, you know, I'm hoping it's temporary, you know, but I'm going to keep my eyes open. I'm going to, you know, be in a state of heightened preparedness.
Right. Now, I know I just said I was going to let you go, but one more follow-up to that. So, so you said that this was, you think this is the last hurrah of these guys. Now, you don't think that with everything you said being true, I mean, obviously their numbers are dwindling, but you don't think that what we're seeing is probably going to be an uptick because as they see that, you know, they'll be able to more outwardly point to, hey, look what's happening, and yeah, and blame these and blame basically these scapegoats,
yeah,
that they'll be able to bring more of these folks on their side. And again, I think we're going more into the guys I want to talk about next time. And I do, this is, yeah, obviously they're in many ways they're all one and the same, but for my purposes in looking at all these fringe groups to the very minutia of what they believe, I do think there's some sort of difference. There's a way to separate them a bit, because I don't think, you know, like you mentioned, there's the ones who are proud the Holocaust happened, and then there's the, yep, ones who pretend it didn't. And right, while they both have a deep-seated hatred of Jews, they're both sort of fighting the same battle and at the same time fighting a different war, I guess you can explain.
So, sure.
So what would, so could you speak to that? Do you think, I do think the white supremacists, like these current day, really the Trumpian types are yeah, going to gain in numbers. But for these Holocaust deniers, like these more, the types that we've been talking about who've been around for many, many decades.
Yeah.
Do you think they're going to be the ones who sort of lose their... Because I do think that the Holocaust denial stuff is going to end up... I think you're right there. I think the future of the white supremacist movement will not be able to deny the Holocaust. They'll be able to herald it as a great success story of, yeah, in their history.
Yeah.
So
well,
do you think that...
I mean,
yeah, go ahead.
I think first of all, a couple of things. First of all, the white nationalist movement in the United States made an enormous mistake by hitching their wagon to Trump. I mean, when they tried this in the 1930s, they chose Lindbergh, you know, and now they chose Trump. And because it's because he's so corrupt and so visibly corrupt and so unpopular with a significant proportion of people in this country, it's going to be a discredit to their movement that they tied themselves to him in the first place. So I think that that's going to do a lot of damage to them, A. B, I think obviously there's going to be a significant proportion of people who are going to be, you know, who are going to espouse white supremacy in some way, right? That doesn't mean they're going to be in the Klan, but they're going to want their positions as white people in this country to remain uppermost, right?
Right.
But I think that there's an enormous number of people in this country who are uncomfortable about where their position is in the fluidity of our demographics, right? And for to prevent those people from drifting toward these much smaller groups who are much more radical and much more dangerous, there has to be economic justice for them because they're suffering like everybody else is. And this is sort of like, you know, I think back to, you know, to Howard Zinn. I mean, this is the great division of working people in the United States on the basis of race. You know, rather than hating your boss, hate the guy that's a different race from you who's competing against you for your job. Rather than you guys joining the same union and making sure you both get the same pay. And I think that it's great that Sanders is out there communicating that message finally and going to these communities and showing these people by just sitting down with them for a half an hour and explaining to them in the detail that they need to understand it what economic justice actually looks like and how they have actually voted against their own self-interest.
Right.
When people, you know, people might not ever love the people that aren't like them, but that we don't need them to love each other. We need them to accept that we live in the same country and we're all on the same side. Economic justice could go a long way toward accomplishing that. I really do believe that.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I do think it's really underrated that we're going a little bit off with the bringing up Bernie Sanders, but yeah. I really do think it's underappreciated and undercovered and underrated at how powerful it is in this moment in time, especially that one of the presidential frontrunners, the person who's invigorated the left,
yeah,
and is the ideological leader of literally the next generation of the Democratic Party, people under, yeah, the age of 50, especially, yeah, millennials and Generation Z,
yeah,
is a Jewish man who has family who died in the Holocaust.
Right, right.
And it's quite frankly disgusting to me when in this moment in time, he just gets thrown aside by certain Bernie haters as, yeah, just another old white guy. That's a whole nother discussion, yeah, about Jewish people and whiteness, but it's just to not in the age of Donald Trump and the rise of white supremacy, I don't see how you do not bring that very specific and very important background fact about him up. But yeah, that's for another day, and you will be, I hope everyone enjoyed
that's
this interview. I hope everyone enjoyed this interview, because Dr. Andrew Mathis, you will without a doubt be on this show again, because we still got to talk about the current day factions of this movement, especially my favorite floor pooper, Chuck C. Johnson.
Yes.
You might hear my
dog barking. I'm going to need to go take him out.
Okay. Well, we don't want another, we don't want you to have a floor pooper in your house.
Floor pooping. Exactly.
So,
Matt, thanks a lot.
Take care. Doctor, I guess. Should I call you Doctor?
Andrew.
Thanks,
we'll
Andrew.
Talk soon.
Take care. Have a good night.
You too.
All right. Let me just. Bloop, bloop. I love that Skype sound. I should get it. I don't even know if you guys hear it. I don't think you do. So let's go to the members half of the show. And first off, let's thank the patrons who make this show possible. Patreon.com/MattBinder. If you can afford to become a patron, please do so. I ask for $5. A month. You can give more. You can give less. It will help me grow this show. Right now, I'm doing an episode a week. Usually, it goes about an hour to two, sometimes 2.5 hours. I'm trying to cut down those longer ones so I can give extra instead of just those really long episodes. But right now, that's what it is. And the interview portion is free for everybody. But if I don't have patrons, even the free portion wouldn't happen. Because I do need a little bit of funding to help keep the show going, pay for hosting of the podcast, all that fun stuff. Equipment when necessary. But as a bonus, the patrons get the audio of the second half, which is me sometimes talking about what happened in the day, sometimes shooting the shit, reading your questions, your comments from the YouTube live stream chat. I recently started using Restream, which allows me to simultaneously stream to YouTube, Facebook, Twitch, Periscope, aka Twitter's live stream platform. I don't really have a Twitch audience, but I noticed that there was a Periscope audience out there I did not know I had previously to using this software. So, welcome, guys. You can go to youtube.com/MattBinder and subscribe there so you can get notifications when I go live. Also, I'm going to be doing produced short standalone videos that are not part of the podcast to upload to the YouTube channel. I'm going to do them regardless, but it would be very helpful. And I'd be able to put out way more if we're able to go to the Patreon members. So without any further ado, these are the people who help fund the show and make it all possible. Abigail T, Adam Q, Alan B, Andrew H, Benji A, Bobby M, Champagne Communist G, Christine H, Colin R, Dave K, David Z, Dragon Slayer, Floaties, Froz K, Francis Zek, FTW, All Day, Greg D, Ian J, Jameson Test, Janelle A, Jasmine H, Jeff K, Jonathan B, Jordan V, Joseph R, Josh C, Katie S, Kyle, Max W, User Me, Michael J, Michael M, Mr. Danks, Nicole A, Namde Net, Omid M, Romina O, Sina, the wonderful people over at Struggle Session, TM, Tamni G, Thaddeus A, Tina M, Tom G, Tom M, Trin AE, Will P, and Zarin. You can also support this show by, like I mentioned earlier, subscribing to YouTube, youtube.com/MattBinder, or doomed.tv, both will take you there. Doomedpod.com, if you just want to listen to the podcast. You can subscribe to iTunes from there as well. Subscribe via Google Play. If you have a moment, please leave a review on iTunes. Click the stars. Write a little text review. It really helps the show get noticed via podcast platforms. I'm going to look into getting this show on Spotify. I really should have filled out the forms there already, but I dropped the ball on that. But what could you do? You guys know I'm terrible at terrible at self-promotion, but I'm working on it. See you guys all on the members half coming up right now. If you're watching live, don't change that channel. For you audio listeners, you podcasters, see you all next time on Doomed. The idiots are taking over.